Welcome. My pleasure to introduce Mike Van Quickenborg, who is a professor at Everett Community College, and he's going to talk about philosophy and film for three times this week, which we're thrilled about. And today's title is, Should I Take the Blue Pill? And you'll answer that, right?
Well, I'll leave it to the audience.
All right. Thank you,
Mike. All right, thank you.
Do you want this closed?
Probably. It'll be kind of loud, okay. I think. Okay. My library patrons will probably appreciate that. Yeah, so thanks for coming out on a beautiful day. My name is Mike Van Quickenborn, and I'll be the title is Should I Take the Blue Pill? Then the subtitle is The Matrix and Waking Life as Invitations to Philosophical Questioning. So I have websites, and so I just share them here, and you know, you're not going to do that while you're at Hidden Village, but this one here at the top, I have a filmography and bibliography that I've compiled and put as a PDF file on this website. And so if you're interested further in like other films that might have philosophical or address philosophical issues, you can download that, and I've got a bunch of listings there by theme, and then also books and other resources on this topic. Also, I have another website here. I just for the first time here in January taught a class called Ethics in 21st Century World Cinema. So I have a separate website for that, and it also has like a filmography, bibliography along the same lines, more focused on 21st century world cinema and on ethics. My name is Mike Van Quickenborn, as she said. This at symbol here indicates that I have a Twitter handle, and you should all become my followers, right? I'm not on Facebook because Facebook's all about friends, right? I'm not interested. So it's all about followers. So go if you'd like to follow me on Twitter. I'm going to be here throughout the week, and in this particular session, I hope to show how films can motivate some of the most compelling philosophical questions ever considered. And then I'm not sure that the time, you know, we're here till 5:30 officially. I do want to make sure I say that feel free to leave, you know, at any point. And I don't take offense to that at all, because we have stir fry waiting for us as of 4:45. But depending on the time, I hope to be able to get to as well, focus a little bit more on the film The Matrix more carefully, kind of at the end, but we'll see how much time we have. So I do want to thank you for coming out. These three sessions that I'll be doing this week are kind of a condensed version of a class I've been teaching since the turn of the century called Philosophy in the Cinema at Everett Community College. And along with that, in 2008 and 2009, I put together I beat out a different film festival by 6 months, but it was the world's first philosophical film festival called Philosophy in the Dark. I did it for 2 years and then just got tired. So at any rate, I've done that. And then I also wanted to mention here on Wednesday afternoon, I'll be offering something that I'm doing around the state as part of the Humanities Washington Speakers Bureau. If you're from Washington, you might have heard about this. And that has a different topic. That one is entitled The Good Game on the Moral Value of Sports. I should know the title better than that. At any rate, I'll be talking about sports and ethics on Wednesday afternoon. And before that, I was part of the Speakers Bureau since 2015. And for 2 years there, I went around the state and gave a presentation entitled Seriously Funny, Humor, Film, and Philosophy. So I'm all about film and philosophy, and I like sports too. So there we go. So in my philosophy and cinema class, I present the films we'll be looking at this week in their entirety. We're not going to be able to do that here. But I will have clips for you interspersed throughout these talks. And they're, you know, in the order of, you know, 4 to 10 minutes. Most of them are shorter than 10 minutes. I also wanted to say that today's clips and the rest of the clips I'll be showing this week are all of maybe a PG nature, so just so you're aware of that. And another thing that's important to note, I personally believe that there is a 10-year statute of limitations on spoiler alerts. So, sorry, if you haven't seen these films, you're just going to hear spoilers, and I apologize, but that's the way it goes. You can feel free to certainly ask me questions or add comments at any time as I'm going through this. You don't need to wait till the end or anything like that. So just before I get kind of into it, any questions or anything here at the top? Okay. So the first thing I want to talk about is why would somebody want to try and find philosophy in the cinema? And this is sort of a little bit more personal biography on my part. I've been teaching philosophy since 1992, and for the first 6 years of doing so, I honestly struggle, as I think many philosophers do, because you try and get first-year college students, primarily at Everett Community College, to care about material that is quite foreign to them. It's highly abstract. And so for 6 years I struggled until one day in theater in 1998 I saw the film The Matrix, which we'll be looking at here a little bit today. I've long been a fan of the movies, but when I saw The Matrix, I really felt like my eyes were opened in a new way to approach the subject of philosophy using that film. I really hope to, and you can see how this goes for you, but I hope to use something that students were already familiar with and enjoyed, film, to get them to think about some of the most fundamental questions that philosophy has to offer. That's what drew me to film in the first place. So I'm assuming, maybe not all of us, but I'm assuming that maybe none of us have ever attempted to teach philosophy before. And so I want to try and give you a sense of the struggle here that I had today. And so to do that, I wanted to read to you one of the fundamental texts of the Western philosophical tradition, which you might have heard about. And this is from Plato, the ancient Greek philosopher, an excerpt from his dialogue, The Republic. And this is the famous excerpt known as the Allegory of the Cave. You might be familiar with this, but I just want to share this with you. And then from that, we'll pivot to The Matrix, and you can kind of compare the two. So this is from Book 7 of his Dialogue in the Republic. Now, a dialogue is sort of like a little play, right? So you have these different characters talking back and forth from one to the other. Plato primarily used the character of Socrates, who you might also be familiar with or heard of. The ancient Greek philosopher Socrates. Much of what we know of Socrates has actually been handed down to us or filtered through Plato or Plato's dialogues. And so Socrates is the main character in this particular excerpt that I'm going to read to you. And Socrates, scholars say, is really mouthing Plato's view of things. What's happening here is that Socrates is talking to another character by the name of Glaucon. If you'd like to think of it, you can just call Glaucon Patsy, if you like, because you have this character of Socrates in these dialogues, and then you have these other characters that come and go, and they're sort of the patsies that sort of end up, by the end of the dialogue, agreeing completely with everything that Socrates has said, right? So they're not, I would say, sort of full-fledged characters in a play. They're more there to sort of be something for or Socrates or Plato, really, to bounce ideas off of. So here's what Plato wrote, Book 7 of the Republic. And this is Socrates' character now speaking. And now I said, let me show in a figure how far our nature is enlightened or unenlightened. Behold, human beings living in an underground den, which has a mouth open towards the light and reaching all along the den. Here they have been from their childhood and have their legs and necks chained so that they cannot move and can only see before them, being prevented by the chains from turning round their heads. Above and behind them, a fire is blazing at a distance, and between the fire and the prisoners, there is a raised way, and you will see, if you look, a low wall built along the way, like the screen which marionette players have in front of them, over which they show the puppets. And then Glaucon says, I see. Then back to Socrates. And do you see, I said, men passing along the wall, carrying all sorts of vessels and statues and figures of animals made of wood and stone and various materials which appear over the wall? Some of them are talking, others are silent. Glaucon says, you have shown me a strange image, and they are strange prisoners. Like ourselves, I replied. And they see only their own shadows, or the shadows of one another, which the fire throws on the opposite wall of the cave? True, Glaucon said. How could they see anything but the shadows if they were never allowed to move their heads? And of the objects which are being carried in like manner, they would only see the shadows? Yes, Glaucon says. And if they were able to converse with one another, would they not suppose that they were naming what was actually before them? Very true, says Glaucon. And suppose further that the prison had an echo which came from the other side. Would they not be sure to fancy when one of the passers-by spoke that the voice which they heard came from the passing shadow? No question, he replied. To them, I said, the truth would be literally nothing but the shadows of the images. Glaucon says, that is certain. He's just falling for it, right? Okay. Socrates says, and now look again and see what will naturally follow if the prisoners are released and disabused of their error. At first, when any of them is liberated and compelled suddenly to stand up and turn his neck round and walk and look towards the light, he will suffer sharp pains. The glare will distress him, and he will be unable to see the realities of which in his former state he had seen the shadows.
and then conceived someone saying to him that what he saw before was an illusion, but that now, when he is approaching nearer to being, and his eye is turned towards more real existence, he has a clearer vision. What will be his reply? And you may further imagine that his instructor is pointing to the objects as they pass and requiring him to name them. Will he not be perplexed? Will he not fancy that the shadows which he formerly saw are truer than the objects which are now shown to him? Glaucon says, far truer. And if he is compelled to look straight at the light, will he not have a pain in his eyes which will make him turn away to take refuge in the objects of vision which he can see, and which he will conceive to be in reality clearer than the things which are now being shown to him? True, he said. And suppose once more that he is reluctantly dragged up a steep and rugged ascent and held fast until he is forced into the presence of the sun himself. Is he not likely to be pained and irritated? When he approaches the light, his eyes will be dazzled and he will not be able to see anything at all of what are now called realities. Not all in a moment, Glaucon says. He will require to grow accustomed to the sight of the upper world. At first he will see the shadows best, next the reflections of men and other objects in the water, and then the objects themselves. Then he will gaze upon the light of the moon and the stars and the spangled heaven, and he will see the sky and the stars by night better than the sun or the light of the sun by day? Certainly. Last of all, he will be able to see the sun, and not mere reflections of him in the water, but he will see him in his own proper place, and not in another, and he will contemplate him as he is. Certainly. Just a page more. He will then proceed to argue that this is he who gives the season and the years, and is the guardian of all that is in the visible world, and in a certain way the cause of all things which he and his fellows have been accustomed to behold? Clearly, he said, he would first see the sun and then reason about him. That was Glaucon, by the way. Socrates again. And when he remembered his old habitation and the wisdom of the den and his fellow prisoners, do you not suppose that he would felicitate himself on the change and pity them? Glaucon says, certainly he would. And if they were in the habit of conferring honors among themselves on those who were quickest to observe the passing shadows and to remark which of them went before and which followed after and which were together, and who were therefore best able to draw conclusions as to the future, do you think that he would care for such honors and glories or envy the possessors of them? Would he not say with Homer, better to be the poor servant of a poor master, and to endure anything rather than think as they do and live after their manner? Yes, Glaucon says, I think that he would rather suffer anything than entertain these false notions and live in this miserable manner. Imagine once more, Socrates says now, such an one coming suddenly out of the sun to be replaced in his old situation. Would he not be certain to have his eyes full of darkness? To be sure, he said, Glaucon did. And finally now, Socrates ends this part of it. And if there were a contest and he had to compete in measuring the shadows with the prisoners who had never moved out of the den while his sight was still weak, and before his eyes had become steady and the time which would be needed to acquire this new habit of sight might be very considerable, would he not be ridiculous? Men would say of him that up he went and down he came without his eyes, and that it was better not even to think of ascending. And if anyone tried to loose another and lead him up to the light, let them only catch the offender, and they would put him to death. Okay. So, imagine, you know, you're a first-year college student, you've just read this portion of the Republic, it's very frequently assigned to first-year college students. Did that make sense? Maybe you know the story, maybe it does, but do you have questions? Do you know what's going on there? Yeah? Okay. Well, if it's a little bit unclear, I'm hoping the Matrix will fill in some gaps for you here in a minute, okay? I do think that Plato constructs a powerful image here, but I think certainly for most people, it's a bit of a strange image. So in order to get students to feel the force of Plato's story here, for me at least, it's a bit hard to get over the implausibility of the scene, right? So you get the idea that what Plato is suggesting is that all of us, all of humanity, except for, by the way, the philosophers, okay, everybody else, we're prisoners in a cave, Okay, we're prisoners in a cave. And again, I just like to emphasize that these prisoners are chained up in such a way, as Plato says, that they can only look straight in a straight ahead direction. And so then behind them there's this fire burning and people are walking back and forth with things on top of their heads. And so the only thing these prisoners can see are the shadows. But they can also hear people talking about stuff. So you might imagine somebody walks by with like a vase on their head. And then, you know, somebody else is walking by and says, oh, hey, nice vase you've got there. And so these prisoners, right, would see the shadow of a vase in front of them, and then they would hear the word vase, and they'd think, oh, that must be what a vase is. But I still have questions here. You know, why would anybody imprison people in this way? Okay, why is that? Would these prisoners really think that shadows were reality? Right? Now, I get it. Their heads are supposed to be fixed in such a way that they don't ever see their fellow prisoners. They can't see anything except what's straight in front of them, right? At the same time, I mean, I don't know about you, maybe I just have a big nose, but I mean, if I'm looking straight ahead, I can still see the nose at the end of my, you know, it's not a shadow, it's a nose. So I wonder, why would these people really mistake shadows for reality? So I think there's some legitimate questions here to be raised about this allegory. So, having said all of that, we're going to turn to The Matrix. Of all the films I show in my class, this is the one that most people have seen before. And so I wonder, how many of you have seen The Matrix? Almost everybody. Okay, good. I've been teaching this class many years now, starting in 2000. And over the years, actually, more and more of my students have not yet seen it. So many of you have seen it. If you haven't, I think that won't be it. It's not a prerequisite of coming to this session or understanding what we're going to look at here. But it might help. So I'll just give you some context as to the scene we're about to experience here. In The Matrix, right, our young protagonist, Neo, who's portrayed by Keanu Reeves, he's a computer hacker and office worker who has long suspected that a vast conspiracy is at work in the world. He is contacted by this character by the name of Trinity, portrayed by Kerry Moss, and she works for the infamous computer hacker known as Morpheus, and this person's portrayed by Lawrence Fishburne. So what we're about to see is that Neo agrees to meet Morpheus, who he thinks is behind this vast conspiracy. And we're about to see what ensues here, okay? So one of the things that's going to happen in these sessions, I'm going to have to juggle DVDs, so I'll be doing that. But if you could flip the thing to get the projector back, I will find the correct scene here. And I'll turn off the lights here in a second. So we are going to be looking for chapter 9.
This is your last chance. After this, there's no turning back. You take the blue pill, the story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want. You take the red pill, you stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes. Miss Kelly, be what? Be real.
I don't know if you saw it as I do, but in this scene, right, we have the same message that Plato was attempting to impart. What you think is reality is really not. So up to this point in Neo's life, he's lived in what seems to be the late 20th century United States or North America, and he thought that everything he saw around him was real, but after taking this pill, these people tell him that no, it's all just an artificially virtual reality thing created by artificial intelligence. And so I just think that, in fact, the Matrix, to some extent, improves upon Plato, because I think that scene grabs people much more than does that ancient prose, and it's a much more plausible kind of scenario, right? We all, certainly today, are aware of the fact that there is virtual reality, and so I like to, I guess freak out my students by suggesting that, last night when they were asleep in their bedrooms, who knows, maybe the government came along and knocked them out with some sort of knockout gas, secreted them away to probably Area 51, and have now hooked them up to some sort of artificial virtual reality machine. How would they know that hasn't happened? How could anybody say that something like this is not the case right now? So I just find that, again, much more engaging for students. In fact, It might be too engaging. There was an article in the British newspaper, The Independent, entitled, "Tech Billionaires Convinced We Live in the Matrix Are Secretly Funding Scientists to Help Us Break Us Out of It." So, thank goodness. That was back in October 2016 that I saw that headline. Not only that, a philosopher, contemporary philosopher by the name of Nick Bostrom has argued that if we accept certain fairly plausible assumptions, it's not just possible that we're living in a matrix-like simulation, but in fact that it's likely. And I won't get into the details there, but he makes that argument at the very least. It's somewhat interesting. So the first point I want to make is that I do think that film can do a good job of motivating these kinds of philosophical questions. That's not to say that there's not disagreement about that. So you're probably all familiar with the noted film critic Roger Ebert, now passed away. He makes an interesting observation that I think kind of bears on what I'm talking about here today. There's a film called Dark City, which is another fine film that raises a host of philosophical questions, kind of similar to The Matrix, but a little bit more film noir. And on the commentary track to that film, Roger Ebert says that he's always felt that movies are an emotional medium, that movies are not the way to make an intellectual argument. If you want to make a political or philosophical argument, then the ideal medium exists, and that medium is the printed word. And so you might think that anybody who teaches a class on philosophy in the cinema would probably strongly disagree with Ebert here. I don't, actually. I think that, certainly the written word is a good medium for getting across philosophical arguments. But I think that where film can be useful is, as we just saw, it can be useful in motivating people to think about these questions, not necessarily making an argument for a particular conclusion, but getting people to engage these kinds of issues. Because, as Ebert says, they are an emotional medium, and when we get emotionally engaged, we're more likely to really want to sink our teeth into whatever the issue may be here. So, the films I want to say, the films we're going to view parts of this week, I think do an excellent job of raising the kinds of fundamental questions that philosophy attempts to answer. So film can be can often be used in an attempt to bring philosophy to the movie-going masses, but that raises another question, because philosophers have nothing but questions, really. And that is the question of whether or not philosophy should be brought to the masses. Is it appropriate to bring philosophy to the masses? And it might seem obvious to all of us, and certainly to me, that everyone ought to have access to philosophy. But on the other hand, philosophers such as Plato have been seen as notorious elitists, seen as in that way by people such as myself, in fact. On the other hand, a philosopher by the name of Catalin Partien wrote in her entry on Plato's myths in the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, which is a great resource, a free resource on the internet, Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. She wrote that Plato did not abandon Socrates' credo that the philosopher has a duty toward his fellow citizens who do not devote their lives to philosophy. For him, philosophy has a civic dimension. The one who makes it outside the cave should not forget about those who are still down there and believe that the shadows they see there are real beings. The philosopher should try to transmit his knowledge and his wisdom to the others, and he knows that he has a difficult mission. But Plato was not willing to go as far as Socrates did. He preferred to address the public at large through his written dialogues rather than conducting dialogues in the agora in ancient Athens. He did not write abstruse philosophical treatises, but engaging philosophical dialogues meant to appeal to a less philosophically inclined audience. So she argues that Plato, in fact, was trying to bring philosophy to some of the masses, and there's maybe a debate about that. So I guess we could say that there is a tradition of making philosophy accessible to a wide variety of people, and it goes back a long way. And I guess I would see that as my job, and using film as a key tool in that effort. Okay. So trying to here this week be a little bit of an evangelist for philosophy, so that raises this question, why do philosophy in the first place? And I would say that without the ability to talk about fundamentally important questions, we human beings are left to violence and manipulation. And I wanted to motivate that thought or that idea by looking at a clip from a different film now. And this is Richard Linklater's 2001 animated film, Waking Life. How many of you have seen this film, Waking Life? Just
Three of you. Okay, good. So as I said earlier, maybe I didn't say it, but I do like to bring new films to people. So Waking Life is an excellent film, and I encourage you to see it. But I'm going to show you a couple of clips from it. And I would say that Waking Life is another candidate for the most philosophical film ever made. It's kind of hard to describe. Those of you who've seen it know this, I think. But the way I would think of it is that Waking Life is sort of a philosophical fruitcake. It's very dense, and it's got a lot of different questions that get raised by the film. The plot of Waking Life is very loose, but the main idea in that film is it follows an unnamed character who's being played by Wiley Wiggins. And this character seems to be trapped in a dream, right? Just as we heard Morpheus there, Lawrence Fishburne, saying to Neo, how do you know you're not in a dream? Well, this same idea is picked up here in Waking Life. There's this character, he seems to be trapped in a dream, and he's trying to wake up, but he's never sure if he's able to actually do that. And so what happens to this character in this movie is that he encounters a whole host of characters, mostly unnamed thinkers in a variety of fields, including philosophy. So the clip I'm going to show you here first, we have Wiley Wiggins' character, again, an unnamed character. He's going to be talking to another unnamed character portrayed by the actor J.C. Shakespeare. I'm going to show you two clips from the Waking Life here today. And in fact, I did want to mention, so on Wednesday, when I do the talk about sports and ethics, there's going to be a clip from Waking Life in that one as well. So we'll see. How was the sound with the Matrix? Was it too loud or not loud enough?
Turn it up a little bit.
You think a little bit louder?
Yeah. Okay.
That's Wiley Wiggins, the main character.
Self-destructive man feels completely alienated, utterly alone. He's an outsider to the human community. He thinks to himself, I must be insane. What he fails to realize is that society has, just as he does, a vested interest in considerable losses and catastrophes. These wars, famines, floods, and quakes meet well-defined needs. Wants chaos. In fact, he's gotta have it. Depression, strife, riots, murder, all this dread. We're irresistibly drawn to that almost orgiastic state created out of death and destruction. It's in all of us. We revel in it. Sure, the media tries to put a sad face on these things, painting them up as great human tragedies. But we all know the function of the media has never been to eliminate the evils of the world. No. Their job is to persuade us to accept those evils and get used to living with them. The powers that be want us to be passive observers. You got a match? and they haven't given us any other options outside the occasional purely symbolic participatory act of voting. You want the puppet on the right or the puppet on the left? I feel that the time has come to project my own inadequacies and dissatisfactions into the socio-political and scientific schemes. Let my own lack of a voice be heard.
So, kind of a dramatic scene there. I would say, I would roughly define philosophy as the following. Philosophy is a non-empirical subject that attempts to answer the fundamental questions that arise in all areas of life. And I see philosophy, one of the things it can be used for, one of the things it's useful for, is to be able to engage these questions. Because without philosophy, without being able to think philosophically, we end up in alienation. That's, in fact, what this particular scene is called, or this chapter of the DVD is called alienation. I also think that one of the things this scene reveals is that, as you saw, the one character there who ends up immolating himself is doing all the talking. It's not a dialogue there. And I think that philosophy is, you know, done most acutely or most productively in dialogue with other people. And I think, again, studying philosophy enables us to do this. This is just maybe completely coincidental, I don't know, but if you remember back in 2011, or 2010 maybe it was, there was a mass murder committed by Jared Loughner in Tucson, Arizona. If you remember this, many years ago now. Apparently he was obsessed with this film. And, I mean, maybe, I don't know, this film has many different scenes, and I think it ends up on a hopeful note, and I think that you'll see in just a minute a different scene that expresses a very different sentiment. But I thought that's an interesting connection here. So I think that film can be a useful medium for prompting philosophical reflection. I think it gives people important tools to be able to deal with the fundamental questions that we all have. But a related and possibly more important question is whether or not film is a particularly good medium to impart truth. So just to get back to the allegory of the cave here for a minute, right, Plato is suggesting there that all of us non-philosophers are trapped in a cave, and everything we perceive around us with our physical senses is just an illusion. It's a shadow of the ultimate reality. For Plato, to discover true ultimate reality, we might say, you actually have to be able to think in a rational manner, philosophically speaking. For Plato, the ultimate reality is a world he calls the world of forms. And the world of forms is a world where basically, you're just thinking about the concepts, the world of concepts. So, for example, we can go out here in the woods and look at a flower, right? That flower, according to Plato, is not ultimately real. What's ultimately real is the form of a flower. The form of a flower is whatever it is that all flowers have in common. So if you take, you know, a rose, and you take a daisy, and however many different flowers you have, whatever it is that all flowers have in common, that is the concept of a flower, that is the form of a flower. For Plato, that's actually ultimate reality, the form of a flower. And it doesn't exist in the perceivable world, and this is why philosophers, those who can kind of see through or see past our perceptions to these concepts, are best equipped to understand reality. Well, one implication of that is that Plato was actually very critical of art, because what do artists do, right? They use their senses to perceive, let's say, a flower, and then they say, paint a flower. Then they're hoping that other people come along, we might say, and look at that flower. Well, when you look at a painting of a flower, you're not even looking at the thing that the form of the flower is generating. You're even one step further removed from the form of the flower. And so Plato thought that art was actually to be discouraged, which I laugh with you. I think that's kind of a bizarre thing to think about. So I don't agree with Plato in that, by the way. But Plato's point was that art can be dangerous. While I don't agree with that or endorse that view wholeheartedly by any means, I think it's clear that film can in fact present us with certain dangers. Yeah. So, David Foster Wallace, a noted writer, wrote an essay called David Lynch Keeps His Head, from a book, was collected in a book called A Supposedly Fun Thing That I'll Never Do Again. And David Foster Wallace writes the following there. Movies are an authoritative medium. They vulnerabilize, sorry, it's a difficult word for me. They vulnerabilize, like vulnerable, and yeah. Okay, you got it, allies, thank you. They vulnerabilize you and then dominate you. Part of the magic of going to a movie is surrendering to it, letting it dominate you. The sitting in the dark, the looking up, the tranced distance from the screen, the being able to see the people on the screen without being seen by the people on the screen, the people on the screen being so much bigger than you, etc. Film's overwhelming power isn't news. So that was Wallace, right? For example, though, if you see the film Jaws, and then you go swimming in the ocean, right? It's probably very likely that you're going to be much more concerned about being killed by a shark than if you hadn't just seen the film Jaws, right? So we can experience that power of film that way. But in these sessions, right, and thinking about film philosophically, we're not watching films just to be entertained. And Wallace considers this as well. So he continues that same passage here as follows. But different kinds of movies use this power in different kinds of ways. Art film is essentially teleological. It tries in various ways to, quote, wake the audience up, unquote, or render us more conscious. This kind of agenda can easily degenerate into pretentiousness and self-righteousness and condescending horse twaddle, but the agenda itself is large-hearted and fine. Commercial film doesn't seem like it cares very much about an audience's instruction or enlightenment. Commercial film's goal is to entertain, which usually means enabling various fantasies that allow the moviegoer to pretend he's someone else and that life is somehow bigger and more coherent and more compelling and attractive and in general just more entertaining than a moviegoer's life really is. You could say that a commercial movie doesn't try to wake people up, but rather to make their sleep so comfortable and their dreams so pleasant that they will fork over money to experience it. This seduction, a fantasy for money transaction, is a commercial movie's basic point. An art film's point is usually more intellectual or aesthetic, and you usually have to do some interpretive work to get it, so that when you pay to see an art film, you're actually paying to do work, whereas the only work you have to do with regard to most commercial films is whatever work you did to afford the price of a ticket. So, now it's me again, not Wallace. It would seem that at least some films have the goal, according to Wallace, of waking people up to reality. Now, the question, though, is whether or not films are particularly good at that task. I want to say it's a little bit of an advertisement for tomorrow's session. So tomorrow's session is entitled, Is There Any Winning the Battle for Truth? And so I'm going to get more into discussing the concept of truth and how it relates to film and philosophy tomorrow, and looking at the films Adaptation and The Battle of Algiers. But so we'll look at that more tomorrow. But I think the following clip I want to show you from Waking Life again helps to point out that film does have a particularly important relationship to reality. Okay, so to set up that clip, I'll let you know what you're going to be looking at here is the director Kaveh Zahidi, and he's going to be talking to an actor and artist by the name of David Jewell, and they're going to be having a chat. Zahidi will refer to in this talk a noted film critic, André Bazin. He's a noted French film critic and theorist, and he lived in the middle of the 20th century. Okay, and so. Again, I think this clip gives us some sense as to the relationship of film to reality. Thank you to my assistants for the lights and the piece of paper there. Okay. So we're going to go here. All right. Okay, here we go. Thank you. I don't have an easy way to fast forward to the part I want to get to, so we'll just experience this.
Cinema, in its essence, is what's about to go to reality. Just that, like, reality is actually reproduced. And he, for him, it's not like a storytelling medium, really. You know, and he feels like film, like literature is better for telling a story. Mm-hmm. You know, like, and if you tell a story, or even like a joke, like, you know, this guy walks into a bar, and, you know, he sees a dwarf, you know. Like, you know, that works really well because you're imagining this guy and this dwarf and this bar, and there's this kind of like imaginative aspect to it. But in film, you don't have it because you actually are filming a specific guy in a specific bar with a specific dwarf of a specific height in a certain way. Right? Mm-hmm. So, like, for Bazin, what the ontology of film has to do is has to do with, you know, really with photography also has an ontology of,
right?
Because it has this dimension of time to it, you know, and like this greater realism. And so, like, it's about that guy at that moment in that space. And you know, Bazin is like a Christian, so he like believes that, you know, God obviously, and that like everything, he believes, for him, reality and God are the same, you know, like, and so what film is actually capturing is like God incarnate, creating, you know, and like this very moment, like, you know, God is manifesting as this, and what the film would capture if it was filming us right now would be like God as this table, and God as you, and God as me, and God looking the way we look right now, and saying and thinking what we're thinking right now, because that's, you know, we all got to manifest in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
So film is actually like a record of God, or of the face of God, or of the ever-changing face of God. You have a mosquito. I mean, and like a whole Hollywood thing is just taking like film and like just trying to like make it the storytelling medium where like you take these, you know, books or stories, and then you like, you know, and then like you have the script and you try to find somebody who sort of fits the thing, but it's ridiculous because it's not, it shouldn't be based on the script, you know, it should be based on the person, you know, or the thing. And in that sense, they're almost right to have this whole star system, because then it's about like that person, you know.
Right, yeah.
You know, instead of like the story. You know, like Truffaut always said that, you know, the best films are made, the best scripts don't make the best films, you know, because they have that kind of literary, you know, narrative thing, you know, that you're sort of a slave to. The best films, you know, are the ones that aren't like tied to that slavishly. So, so I don't know, the whole narrative thing just seems to me like, you know, obviously there's an activity of cinema because it's in time, just the way there should be the music. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't first think of the story of the song and then make the song, you know, it has to come out of that moment, you know, and that's why the film has it, just that moment, which is holy, you know, like, this moment, you know, it's holy. But like, you walk around like it's not holy. You walk around like, you know, there's some holy moments and there are all the other moments that are not holy, right?
Right.
But like, this moment's holy, right? And if that film can let us see that, you know, can frame it so that we see like, ah, this moment, you know, holy. And it's like, holy, 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 moment by moment. But like, who can live that way, you know? Who can like go, wow, holy? Because if I were to like look at you and just really like let you be holy, I don't know, I would like stop talking.
I mean, yeah, but the moment like, is holy, right?
Yeah, but I'd like, I'd be open, and then I'd like look in your eyes, and I'd cry, and I'd like feel all this stuff, and that's like not polite. I mean, it would make you uncomfortable.
So you could laugh too, though. I mean, why would you cry?
Well, because, I don't know, it, for me, like, I just tend to cry.
Uh-huh. Well, is
well, I was doing it. Like, it's a holy moment.
Everything is layers, isn't it?
I mean, yeah.
There's the holy moment, and then there's the awareness of trying to have a holy moment. In the same way that the film is the actual moment really happening, but then the character pretending to be in a different reality. And it's all these layers. And I was in and out of the holy moment, looking at you. You can't be in a holy moment. You're unique that way, Kaveh. That's one of the reasons I enjoy you. You can bring me into that.
Thanks again. I think it's very clear that film has sometimes a very dubious relationship to reality or to the truth. And again, just take the Jaws example, right? You see the movie Jaws, you go in the ocean, you have much more fear that you're going to be attacked by a shark than is reasonable, right? Because getting attacked by a shark is very unlikely. Despite the fact that it has, you know, sometimes a dubious connection between film and reality or the truth, I think one thing that film can do is allow us to focus on aspects of reality that might otherwise go unnoticed, kind of what these two individuals are doing here in this scene. And then enable us to look for those aspects of reality in our own experience. So that's one of the reasons I just want to give you that a scene there as well. So, up to this point, I have not talked to you about the blue pill. It's the title of the thing, so I should probably say something about that. And so I want to get to that here. This last part of the discussion, or it hasn't been a discussion, so we need to discuss. Okay, let's do that. But the last part of this talk is now going to move and also kind of then will flow into tomorrow's as well, because we're going to talk about the truth a little bit. So tomorrow, I want to let you know again, I'm going to look at the postmodern challenge to the notion of truth and whether there's any winning the battle for truth. Having said all that, I love The Matrix as a film, despite Keanu Reeves, probably. And as I've said, you know, as a tool for motivating philosophical reflection. But philosophically speaking, I think the film The Matrix has a lot of issues or problems, as I would put them. As I asked earlier, many of you have already seen the film The Matrix, which is great. And if you recollect that, and even just from what we saw here earlier today, you might recall that, of course, Neo is the one, quote-unquote, the one, and he is the hero of the film. At least the film is trying to suggest that. I think that's a mistake. In fact, we saw him briefly in the earlier scene, but I would argue, or I'm here to tell you, that the real hero of The Matrix is in fact Cypher, portrayed by Joe Pantoliano. So Cypher is one of the people who has been rescued, quote unquote, I'll put that in quotes, rescued by Morpheus and company. And they are the ones who, you know, are aware of reality, right? And so Morpheus is the guy who says to Neo, welcome to the real world after he's taken the red pill, in fact, and had his whole reality deconstructed. And so Cypher, has been rescued by Morpheus and all these other people. And by the way, I call them, because it's hard to, what do you call these people who are out there rescuing people and waking them up to the nature of reality? I call them Zionistas, because their sort of homeland where they're trying to get to is a place called Zion in the story of the film. So I call them Zionistas. And as we're going to see in the next clip, what we're going to see is Cypher meeting with, first of all, we're going to see him talking to Neo, and then we're going to see Cypher meeting with one of the agents of the artificial intelligence that is creating the Matrix in this virtual reality world. And this agent is, the actor there is Hugo Weaving. And so what Cypher is going to be talking to the agent about is actually the possibility of being able to return to the Matrix. Okay, so I have to juggle DVDs once more, and then we'll get to that.
Information to decode the Matrix. You get used to it. I don't even see the code. All I see is blonde, brunette, redhead. Hey, you want a drink? You know, I know what you're thinking. Because right now I'm thinking the ever since I got here. Why didn't I take the blue pill? Good shit, huh? Belzer makes it. Good for two things. Degreasing engines and killing brain cells.
Oh!
So, can I ask you something? Did he tell you why he did it? Why you're here? Jesus! What a mind job! So you're here to save the world. What do you say to something like that? A little piece of advice. You see an agent, you do what we do. Run. Run your ass off. Sweet dreams.
Do we have a deal, Mr. Reagan?
You know, I know this steak doesn't exist. I know that when I put it in my mouth, the Matrix is telling my brain that it is juicy and delicious. After 9 years, you know what I realize? Ignorance is bliss.
Then we have a deal.
I don't remember nothing. Nothing. You understand? I don't want to be rich. You know, someone important. Like an actor.
Whatever you want, Mr. Reagan.
Okay. Get my body back in the power plant. Reinsert me into the Matrix. I'll get you what you want.
Access codes to the Zion mainframe.
No, I told you I don't know them. And get you the man who does.
Morpheus.
Okay.
Thanks one more time. So let me, I'll get to Cypher here in a minute, but he is supposed to be a villain. In fact, later in the movie, I think most of you know this, he ends up killing, you know, a bunch of Neo's friends in, you know, more or less cold blood. So when I say he's the real hero of the film, I mean, it's a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but there's something to that. So to kind of motivate that, and to go back to the first clip from The Matrix, where, again, Neo has met Morpheus, and he takes the red pill, so there's red and blue, and so he takes the red pill, and then, you know, he's woken up in that vat, and he now realizes what the real world is like. I mean, and so in an attempt to see if we can generate some discussion here, I mean, do you think that Neo should believe what Morpheus tells him? He takes a pill, his hand melts, and he can put his finger in mirrors, and then he, you know, sort of wakes up and so forth, and this guy tells him, welcome to the real world. Should Neo believe Morpheus when he says that?
Well, in effect, you've created such doubt about reality that you've got two different worlds that you can go back and forth between, but then how do you distinguish which one is whatever reality is supposed to be?
Okay, so you think he should? You're saying you think he shouldn't believe?
I don't know where they should or shouldn't. It's just that that experience in itself creates a significant sense of doubt about which one.
Okay, which for me, right? So to me, that suggests, well, you're saying he should probably remain agnostic about, well, what is the real world? Like,
perhaps.
Yeah.
Or I'm not yet sure how you would distinguish.
Right. Right. When I first started teaching this class, and The Matrix had just come out before the sequels, of course, there are two other films in this series, I like to tease them by this. So before The Matrix Reloaded, this is the second one, I like to tease my students by saying, oh yeah, have you heard about the sequel to the film, right? The Matrix 2, The Dream Within the Dream, right? Because like that, how do we know he's not going to wake up yet again and say, oh no, this isn't reality either, right? You were just having another hallucination. Of course, you know, it didn't get made that way, but that got turned into another film called Inception. Yes. So, not really, but anyway, if you've seen Inception, then you would know what I'm talking about. Sorry. So, we have to realize that Morpheus, right, or not Morpheus, Neo has spent about 25 years, right, living just as you and I live, you know, experiencing the world, everything seems however it might seem. And then he imagines there's some master computer hacker on the internet goes by the name of Morpheus, finally meets who supposedly this guy is, and this guy gives him a pill, right? Takes a pill, has a really bad trip, we might say, and then this guy says, now here's reality. I actually would think, you know, if you spent 25 years experiencing reality one way, and then you spend, you know, a couple weeks, a day, experiencing reality another way, after taking some weird pill from some weird guy that you met on the internet, you know, I think you should take, you know, a significant grain of salt before you say, oh yeah, this is reality now. And I think that's important, because, again, we haven't seen this in these scenes, and now I'll just kind of work up to why I think Cypher has something important here, is saying something important. Because what happens is that Morpheus and Neo and the Zionistas, as I'm calling them, they are on a mission. They are on a mission to free people from illusion, right? And we can bring this back to the cave. The person who leaves the cave and sees what is truly real and realizes that, no, shadows aren't reality. These other things are reality. That person goes back into the cave, and then Plato says, well, imagine if this person tried to free somebody else, right? What would they do to that person? Well, they would try and kill them. That was sort of where I ended that passage from the Republic. They would try and kill them. But the idea is that Plato thinks that people should try and free people from this ignorance. And the same thing is going on with the Zionistas. Well, as we see in the film, in scenes we're not looking at here today, but as we see in the film, the Zionistas really, they acquire quite the body count when it comes to trying to free people from the Matrix. Because what happens is when somebody, they can re-enter the Matrix in a special way, and then they can, they are attempting to, again, try and wake up as many people as they can, but in the process, a lot of people are dying. And there's a lot to say there, but a lot of people get killed as a result of their mission to free people from the world of illusion. And the question is, well, is it really worth it? At least the question for me is it really worth it, right? Think about Cypher. Cypher wants to go back into the Matrix. I don't think that's such a bad idea, honestly. I mean, he should, you know, kill his friends to do so. But why is it such a bad idea to want to go back into the Matrix? In the Matrix, right, as we saw in that scene, in the Matrix, you can eat a juicy steak and still be a vegan, right? Because it's just an illusion. Some is cow. Okay. In the Matrix, you can smoke a cigar and not get lung cancer, because it's all an illusion. It's just a virtual reality. We didn't see it in these scenes, but in the real world that the Zionistas, again, as I call them, are trying to wake people up to, the real world is horrible. Okay? They have to live underground. The sky has been scorched and so forth, and they have to live in caves, and they eat, actually, in the scene that was just going to follow here, you see them eating, and they eat a goop. It's just like this tasteless goop, and that's what they have to eat, and life is not very pleasant at all. And the Zionistas are, hey, everybody, let's wake up to this reality. Stop living in this fantasy world of the late 20th century with, you know, all the wonderful things that people experienced in the late 20th century. And so Cypher's idea of, you know, wanting to go back into the Matrix, at least for me, is not necessarily a bad idea. At least I would push that idea, right? And also, I mean, yeah, he's going to kill a few people in the process of doing it, Cypher is, but it's going to be three or four people, as we will see in the film, or you would see if you watched it. But again, the Zionistas, a lot of people are dying, many, many people. There's a big scene in the film, of course, where Neo and Trinity enter this building, this office building, to free Morpheus, and there's just, the bullets are flying. It's a great, you know, great sequence there. But lots of people are actually dying in the real world, because when you die in the Matrix, you die in the real world. Anyway, that's me kind of trying to push that line of thinking here. I think what it gets me to ask, and I'll ask you all again, is I'm not sure where your allegiances lie, if you're sympathetic to Morpheus and Neo and the Zionistas trying to wake people up to reality, or if you're more sympathetic to Cypher. But I guess the question there that it prompts is, what's so great about the real world anyway?
Statement. The welcome to the real world is quite a thing that I see dealing with people out in work and play, who, in some form, according to my judgment, deny what is happening. And the thing of when certain things are exposed
right.
to these people, it's, you know, just classic words of welcome to the real world. Mm-hmm. It may hurt.
They hurt, you said?
It may hurt.
It may hurt, uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
It may hurt.
Mm-hmm.
But reality is present in front of you. When it presents itself where you have to make the choice, mm-hmm. Is it better to die as in to be reborn, or is it better to keep on denial that this isn't happening?
Mm-hmm.
It goes from hunger, especially in hunger, and people out in the streets, street people living on the streets,
okay.
where the lady from Westlake Hills judges why I'm buying 32 cans of Vienna sausage with a pop top. She goes, "Maya, aren't we hungry?" I said, "No, this is for the food pantry. It's easier to pop it off." He says, "Well, that really is not right. Those people just need to work, and that's not really a problem."
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, it's not for me to say, "Welcome to the real world." My point was to just turn and ignore and thank the cashier for giving me a discount on 20 cans of Vienna sausage. And I don't know if it's good for me to say welcome to the real world, but the real world is too much ignored.
Okay.
It's too much ignored, and we see it every day, and people who can't make a living and afford housing, and the employers thinks they're getting overpaid. So, you know, real world is dangerous. Real world hurts.
Okay.
And that's the philosophy part of it, is where do we and how do we make that judgment to where we want to step out into that area.
Okay.
And it is very, very hard to, you know, philosophize galore about what could happen until you take that step with a red pill.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Two thoughts on your question. One is, to critique the blue pill option from a Christian perspective is two things. One, the only way, maybe three things, the only way to live in that false reality is one that bodies have to be enslaved.
Mm-hmm.
The only way the world, the matrix, exists.
Right.
Bodies are literally enslaved.
In vats, right?
In vats,
mm-hmm.
right. To be used for someone else's purposes rather than for their own inherent integrity.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a strong Christian critique of that as mm-hmm. any acceptable reality.
Mm-hmm.
And I forgot where I was going to go with that. Mm-hmm. But then the second thing is, how is any of that different from the option of saying, because life is hard, why don't I just live in an opioid-induced bliss
mm-hmm.
until my body can't do it anymore?
Right. Yeah. And I guess, and then to, you know, opioid or kind of more in the context of the film, right? Virtual reality or video games, you know, or some sort of, you know,
right.
Computer-related environment. And so, for example, on Wednesday, at the end of my talk on sports and morality, touch on esports, people, you know, kind of devoting their lives to playing video games. And, you know, is there a critique that can be made of why are you investing so much of your life in that? And I think it has to do with bodies. And so, because we do have bodies and we can't escape that. But the thing that's interesting, I think, about The Matrix is that you know, the life was better in the Matrix than it was in the real world. Mm-hmm. And so that question can be raised, why not just go for that? You know, that much better world that was, you know, the artificial intelligence, as we learn in the film, they're taking pains to make it a world that works for people. I mean, more or less, that's the idea we're given. Not that there isn't homelessness in the virtual world of the Matrix, but it's certainly, you know, on a whole, much more pleasant environment than what exists in reality. And so I think it makes that a difficult question. I think for many people, they might argue that, well, why we ought to prefer the real world is that it's much more like stable, let's say. It's much more permanent, some people might argue. So for example, there was a time when people were really interested in spending a lot of time on video games or video worlds called like Second Life and Ever, something mm-hmm. with Ever. And you know, I heard about stories where people would spend, you know, 12 hours a day playing these games, more than half their lives on these video game platforms, and that sounded bizarre to me. Well, one of the reasons I think was because, you know, if there's a power failure wherever the computers were being served and so forth, their whole world disappears. It's, you know, it's not very significant or stable a world. But in the Matrix, it's almost as if the opposite is the case. Because the real world is much more tenuous than the Matrix. Because it, at least in the first film, the artificial intelligence sort of has the upper hand. And they are much more likely to persevere or to succeed than the Zionistas. And so if we're going to measure, well, which world should you commit yourself to in terms of like stability or likelihood to continue, it would seem that the Matrix suggests you ought to commit to the Matrix rather than the real world. Having said that, of course, Neo is the hero of the film and the whole series. So the makers of the film, the Wachowski siblings, want to say that, no, we ought to be devoted to reality. My question, this kind of leads into another channel, but yeah, my question is, and this will get into tomorrow, is sometimes that when people think they have the truth with a capital T, right, they become sort of like terrorists with regard to that. They think, I have to bring this to everybody, and I don't care what stands in my way. I think that'll come out more tomorrow. Go ahead.
Well, I think, you know, it's easy for any something like the Matrix or other sci-fi to, you know, to start nitpicking at the details of what,
yeah.
Because there's a lot of things that don't add up, or you don't know the full story.
Sure.
Because the full story hasn't really been written.
Mm-hmm.
But more in terms of thinking about the idea of what we're all trapped in sort of a matrix of a sort,
mm-hmm.
and what's out there that most of us are not seeing or not appreciating, because there's some, you know, artificial intelligence in some sense which is essentially creating the reality for us. And
right.
One example of that is the fact that since, you know, 1980, the economy has basically been kept afloat by increasing levels of debt.
Mm-hmm.
And what that basically means is that everybody kind of thinks they're richer than they are, and they keep on buying stuff. And it kind of keeps everything going.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody in the stock market keeps going up, and people are kind of happy. But the other side of that, or if you take the red pill, is that, well, eventually that's gonna completely explode, or people, everybody at the same time got the idea, wait a minute, we're not quite that rich,
mm-hmm.
we're gonna stop buying so much stuff, everybody kind of collects to themselves and doesn't buy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So, but the downside is that if you don't take the red pill, you are headed to this kind of brick wall that you're going to run into, and it's a social issue too, of social issues which get to a certain point that everything basically collapses,
mm-hmm.
and so. I think the idea of being the Zionistas or whatever is to see this brick wall ahead, and you know, climate's the same thing. See this brick wall ahead and say, wait a minute, you know, we need to break away from this thing which is basically keeping everybody in this false sense of security.
Mm-hmm.
It's not sustainable.
Right?
It's not sustainable, mm-hmm. but everybody kind of thinks it's sustainable, and they think that you know, we could just keep on growing things
right.
forever,
yeah.
and the Earth is never gonna, you know, scream.
Yeah.
Scream back. So that's what
yeah.
I take away from something like The Matrix, and you know, it's there's always little things that are wrong with the plot that kind of stand out.
Yeah, I mean, that's my point, though, is that, and again, I just in terms of the world of the film, it seems as if the Matrix is more sustainable than the real world, because mm-hmm. it's just such a grim existence there. The world has been, the climate's been destroyed to such an extent and so forth. But, so anyway, I think that's, I'm not saying that that's certainly not true of our world, but it is true in that world, that it seems like our expectations have been flipped. We might think that, you know, yes, we wouldn't want to live in a Matrix, but the way things are there, maybe we would, I guess is my point. So, I'm not saying we should today or now or stick our heads in the sand.
I think it would be a great world in the Matrix, personally, because we talk about maybe there's, in the Matrix there, I believe there are homeless.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the Neo, no, decided that he wants to be famous. I want to be special. Well, that's human greed, that's human want for power. And of course, in his little world, he's going to be better than others. And so there will be that whole downstep in his mind. And I think we only live in our minds, you know, we judge through what we've taken in. And that's the easy way out. I mean, I've had those out-of-body dreams of floating. And it would be so sweet to be able to stay in that perfect little world.
To wake up.
Yeah, I don't want to wake up. And that's a deniability. You're denying what God's world is. But gosh, it'd be a lot easier. You know, everyone would conform to what I am.
We're trying, Randy.
I know.
The meta issue is the Matrix itself cannot exist if the real world is not sustainable.
Right.
It exists as a false reality within the real world. And once the power source is used up...
But the human beings are the power source.
Yeah.
Yes, but that is not an infinite source.
It's not a source.
So the Matrix itself will cease to exist if the real world is not cared for.
So it's still...
So I think that's an argument for taking on the responsibility of being in and caring for the real world.
As grim as it might be.
Yes. Because that's the only way for any reality to continue.
Okay.
At least a human reality to be.
You know, a gated community is one sort of a...
Yeah.
Of a little Matrix, because, you know, you... It's nice, you pull in and the gate closes and
right. That's
a nice peaceful place, but that's it. You're throwing out a lot of the...
It's built on the backs of others, of suffering maybe, or something like this.
Yes, especially in Cambodia lately.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks for these comments. Thanks for coming out. And maybe see you later this week for other presentations.
Thank you.
Thanks.